Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents In the Path of Conquest, Resistance to Alexander the Great, by Valdemar Heckel, narrated by James Cameron Stewart. Preface. In order to reach a wider audience and make this book more lively, I have included numerous passages from the ancient sources, believing their words more effective than any paraphrase. The majority of the passages quoted have been translated by my friend John Yardley. There are a few exceptions. Therefore, my first and greatest debt is to him. I am also grateful to the usual group of Alexander scholars to whom I have regularly turned for guidance and instruction. Stefan Franke of Oxford University Press has given support and encouragement throughout the process. I am particularly indebted to Fred Naden, who read and criticized a preliminary version, and to my sister, Annalie Purchase, who corrected numerous mistakes in my writing and forced me to simplify the most convoluted arguments. Special thanks go out also to Sheila Egger, Ed Anson, Liz Bainham, Pierre Briand, Beth Carney, Monica D'Agostini, Conrad Kinsel, Franca Landucci-Gattinoni, and Yossi Roisman, and to my former students Erin Garvin, Carolyn Villikas, and Graham Wrightson. Most of all, I acknowledge the continuing friendship and support of Tim Howe and Sabina Muller, both of whom generously sent me published material that I found difficult to obtain, as well as Larry Treitel, John van der Spoel, and Pat Wheatley. Of course, I thank my family, and it is to the youngest, for now, of them that I dedicate this book. Calgary, October 15th, 2018. Introduction. The 5th century Greek historian Herodotus wrote his histories in order that the great and marvellous deeds, erga megala teke thomasta, performed by the Greeks and the barbarians, would not be without fame, akleia. He viewed the wars fought by the Greeks against Darius I and Xerxes as the continuation of an age-old struggle between East and West that began well before the legendary Trojan War. And indeed, that conflict continued into the 4th century, providing a justification for politicians, kings, and historians alike to write the final chapter in the struggle between the free Greeks and the oppressive Achaemenid Empire. Whatever the true size of Xerxes' army, danger of annexation by the Persian juggernaut was, at the time, very real, even if the Greeks were mistaken in their belief that following their paradoxical repulse of the barbarian, the great king was obsessed with gaining revenge. In fact, the events of the 490s and the following decades were, for the Persians, misadventures on the fringes of an empire with more pressing concerns. Nevertheless, Greek paranoia was fertile ground for motivational speeches by politicians and propagandists. In the 5th century, the Athenian Empire, the Delian League, could be justified, maintained, and enlarged by propaganda that depicted the Persian Empire as an inveterate enemy and ever-present danger. Whatever the true aims of the Macedonian conquest of the East were, fear of Persia proved an effective, if specious, way of uniting the Greek states, who were bound to Philip II and his successor in the League of Corinth, and whose forces served under compulsion. The rhetorician Isocrates, following in the footsteps of his teacher Gorgias of Leontini, who promoted Panhellenism at Olympia in 408, had long anchored his pleas for Greek unity in the image of the great king as the common enemy of the Greeks, although it remained for Philip to give the idea military underpinning. Indeed, participation in a Panhellenic crusade against the age-old enemy gave lustre to the servitude imposed upon the Greeks by their new masters. Through the Greco-Macedonian lens, and with the benefit of hindsight, it is hard to imagine that the expedition against Persia would not have been a success. This book examines the campaign of Alexander from the viewpoint of the conquered peoples, both in mainland Greece and in the East, to the extent that this is possible without resorting to fantasy. Nevertheless, many of the interpretations are speculative, but they are based on the evidence available and attempt to add another dimension to the traditional story of Alexander's conquests. It is, of course, difficult to write an account from the vantage point of the defeated, when the losers of the struggle recorded very little about the conquest, much less about their own view of the enemy, their predicament, intentions, motivations, and actions. To most living in the Persian Empire, written history was an alien concept, and much of the information concerning the Achaemenid Empire, if it found its way into Greek histories, was filtered through the lens of the victor, who constructed a world for the barbarian that reinforced Western prejudices. The barbarian was defeated not only on the battlefield or through tenacious sieges, but also in the court of public opinion. No war crimes tribunals afforded the losers, for it is only losers who are subjected to such inquisitions, a chance to argue their cases. Those whom Alexander regarded as the worst offenders were summarily executed, even if, as in the case of Bessus, the aim was to mollify the native population. How the barbarians viewed Bessus and Barcentes, whether as regicides or martyrs, we cannot say. Nor, given the opportunity, would they have been permitted to speak freely in condemnation of the new master, for even the Macedonians voiced objections at their own peril. What the defeated thought of men such as Mazaeus or Artabazus is also unknown, but one may imagine that they were regarded by many as shameful collaborators. There are official documents, not many, from the losing side. These are simple records of fact, some taking the form of prophecies of events that had already occurred, others preserving practical measures taken to meet the crisis, but all devoid of meaningful comment or judgment. But although the surviving accounts were written in Greek and Latin, all of them long after the conqueror's death, there is more information about the defeated than many imagine. Greek mercenaries who fought in the great king's armies supplied the contemporary historians of Alexander with details concerning numbers, deployment, even tactics. If they themselves were not present at war councils, they could learn the essential arguments presented there from those empowered to relay instructions to their men. There were probably also leaks of more sensitive discussions. The activities of Memnon of Rhodes, whose importance is clearly exaggerated, must certainly have been reported by Greek eyewitness informants. But far more important were the accounts of affairs given by Persians who either were captured or came voluntarily into Alexander's service. Captives could be, and were, routinely interrogated. Laomedon of Mytilene, a naturalized Macedonian, with estates in Amphipolis, and described as bilingual, diglossos, was placed in charge of the barbarian prisoners of war. Furthermore, some prominent Persians had lived for an extended period at the court of Philip II. Hence, they were both well placed to assess the situations before, during, and after the war, and able to communicate, to some extent at least, with their conquerors in Greek. Plutarch tells a story of Alexander as a boy questioning Persian ambassadors about the state of affairs in the Persian Empire, perhaps a reference to his dealings with the exiles at Philip's court. The most important of these, Artabazus, had married a Rhodian woman whose brothers spent many years in Persian service. He, and at least some of his children, particularly his daughter Barcini, who became Alexander's mistress, must have been functionally bilingual. What they reported no doubt found its way into the account of Alexander's official historian, Callisthenes. In many cases, however, we must draw inferences. We know from the histories that lauded the achievements of the conqueror that resistance took different forms and in some cases did not materialize at all. This is surely significant, and it is fruitful to examine why certain groups, some Greeks of Asia Minor, some Phoenicians, the Egyptians, chose surrender and accommodation with the enemy over armed opposition. The history of their deeds or sufferings in the years or even the century before the Macedonian invasion explains their actions and, by extension, their anxieties and attitudes toward not only the conqueror but also their current overlord. Some hesitated to submit because their countrymen were virtual hostages in the armed forces, both on land and at sea, of the Persian Empire. Others were kept loyal to the great king by tyrants or oligarchies who owed position and prosperity to Achaemenid power. Yet others were more concerned with neighbouring arch-rivals and saw in the conqueror a protector or an opportunity to settle old scores. And, of course, there were those who gladly changed allegiance for recognition and retention of local power, just as we can infer the aims of the conqueror from the nature of his treatment of the defeated and the administrative settlements that concluded hostilities. So we may assume that many of the empire's officials, at a variety of levels, were caught in a tug-of-war between loyalty to the Achaemenids and self-interest and preservation. There remains the question of what exactly constituted resistance. In light of the fact that Alexander's campaign was primarily one of military conquest, resistance means, first and foremost, the act of opposing the invader on the battlefield with the aim of driving him, if not out the empire entirely, then at least from one's own territory. Then there was the failure to surrender a city or to cooperate with the invader. Those who resisted in this way held out the vain hope of exhausting the patience of the besiegers or of deterring them by inflicting heavy casualties and destroying their siege engines. Others defended their territory by employing guerrilla warfare and disrupting the invaders' lines of supply and communication, while some submitted but subsequently failed to honour the terms of their surrender. Some clung to the naive belief that the conqueror could be bought off by the extradition of their leaders or of rebels who had taken refuge in their territory. There were even a few who promised neutrality in return for their independence. Such offers were invariably rejected. In the end, it was often a choice between contrition and annihilation. The attitudes and actions of the resistors varied according to their circumstances, their past interactions with foreign overlords, and their forms of government. Nor should we overlook commercial and economic interests. But the determination to resist came, for the most part, from the top, from the ruling elites concerned about local autonomy. The lower strata of society had seen overlords come and go, and they sought assurance that their patterns of life would suffer only minimal disruption. This was especially true of the non-Greek portion of the Persian Empire. In the Greek cities, the masses saw, in the overthrow of oligarchies and the establishment of democracies, opportunities for greater power. Enslavement was a high price to pay for protecting the interests of the ruling classes. This book deals with resistance in a number of forms. The attempt by certain peoples to prevent their subjugation by the conqueror, military resistance, perhaps more aptly described as confronting aggression. The efforts of those who sought to overthrow the new governments that followed defeat on the battlefield or negotiated surrender, rebellion or insurgency, malfeasance on the part of officials who were either newly appointed or retained in their former positions, and finally, the unwillingness of the Macedonian troops to condone the policies or the behaviour of their own king. Conspiracy, insubordination, and mutiny. 1. In the face of Panhellenic War, Greece and the Eastern Mediterranean, 340 to 334. Alexander's crossing of the Hellespont in May 334 surprised no one in Asia Minor. A war against Persia whether for control of the littoral or for a larger purpose, had been expected by Achaemenid officials since 340 at the latest. Philip II's long and unsuccessful siege of Perinthus, followed by an attack on Byzantium via Celimbria, had been countered not only by military support from various Greek states, most notably Athens, but also by aid authorized by Artaxerxes III Ochus, the Persian king who had done so much to revive the empire's fortunes after the ineffectual reign of his father, Artaxerxes II. Although Philip's domination of European Greece was not yet guaranteed, signs of an impending war with Persia were clearly visible to those who cared to turn their attention to East-West relations. Such an undertaking was already being promoted in certain circles south of Thermopylae. Indeed, Isocrates had written in his Letter to Philip of 342, when the Macedonian king was engaged in his Thracian War, "As for the barbarians with whom you are now at war, however, it will be enough for you to subdue them only to the point of establishing security for your own land. But you must try to crush the king now called Great, so as to boost your own reputation, and also make clear to the Greeks who the enemy is that they must fight." The peace of Philocrates of 346, which ended the Sacred War, had gone a long way toward improving Philip's relationship with the Greeks to the south, especially Athens and Thebes, but he was far from prepared, politically or militarily, for a full-scale attack on the traditional or common enemy of the Greeks. The combined lack of overarching authority and common purpose led only to the deterioration of affairs as the reluctant signatories sought to regain lost power. Indeed, the attack on Perinthus was either a sign of, or the stimulus for, the breakdown of Macedonian relations with Athens. The new contest, or rather the resumption of hostilities between Philip and the Athenians, who were incited by the bellicose speeches of Demosthenes and his ilk, would settle the matter once and for all. On the plain of Chaeronea, at the beginning of August 338, Philip, with an army of 30,000 infantry and 2,000 cavalry, defeated a slightly larger coalition force of Athenians and Boeotians, crushing them in an engagement that saw the first display of Alexander's military leadership and the destruction of the vaunted Theban Sacred Band. The victor was able to translate military success into political advantage, forming the League of Corinth, which recognized Philip as hegemon, in short, its director of foreign, viz. Military affairs, and giving an immediate purpose to the Union by declaring a war of vengeance against Persia. The agreement stipulated the contributions of the Allies and penalties for opposing the League's initiatives, the last point pertaining directly, though not exclusively, to Greeks who took up mercenary service in opposition to Philip and his allies. Although a war against Persia to avenge past atrocities had little attraction for the Macedonian soldiers who were to form the core of the army of invasion, neither Philip nor Alexander was oblivious to the value of Panhellenic propaganda. Indeed, Alexander commissioned Callisthenes of Olynthus, a nephew of Aristotle, to promulgate the Panhellenic aspects of the campaign. Among the allied Greeks, most will have recognized these as empty slogans, though, as is always the case with the masses, there were doubtless others who were taken in or simply chose to believe in a higher purpose. But this was yet to come. Philip's war on Persia was inaugurated in the spring of 336, when an advance force of some 10,000, under the command of Attalus, Parmenion, and Amyntas, crossed into Asia Minor. It appears that the bulk of the invading army was to join them in the following spring, for Philip was still selling his mission to the Greek ambassadors in October of 336, when he celebrated the marriage of his daughter Cleopatra to Alexander I of Epirus. As it turned out, this was also the occasion of his own death. the heir to both the throne and the direction of the Panhellenic War would be his son, Alexander III, who by virtue of his conquests has come to be known by the epithet the Great. 1. The consolidation of Macedonian power came at an opportune time. In early 338, Artaxerxes III Ochus was murdered by his vizier Bagoas, who became the power behind the throne, upon which he placed one of the king's sons, Arses. This young man took the regnal name Artaxerxes IV, but his reign was so brief and ineffectual that few modern historians have taken note of his official title. Greek sources, and the Roman writers who used them, were fond of court intrigue, especially when it appeared to involve the harem and much-despised eunuchs. Agoas was, in all likelihood, physically a eunuch, but his power and competence were far greater than what the ancients ascribed to the guardians of the harem. He was both general and kiliarch. In short, he was powerful in the military and at the court, commanding the great king's armies on occasions and controlling access to his person. Through the agency of a court physician, he administered poison to Ochus, but found Arses less compliant than he had hoped, and eliminated him as well, along with his children. The unsuccessful experiment had lasted 2 years. From the depleted royal family, Bagoas now promoted Darius, son of Arsanes, the latter a nephew of Artaxerxes II, to the kingship. But when the vizier sought to remove the new king by poison, his plot was discovered, and the perpetrator forced to drink his own deadly concoction. Such, at least, is the version given by Diodorus of Sicily. Olmsted, in his History of the Persian Empire, remarks, "Bloodthirsty as Ochus had shown himself to be, he was an able ruler, and it is not too far wrong to say that, by his murder, Bagoas destroyed the Persian Empire." That the change of rulers marked a turning point appears true only in retrospect, but the opportunity presented to Philip and Alexander by the destabilization of the Achaemenid court is undeniable, at least in the short term. This view should not be taken to revive the now rightly discredited view of Persian decadence and decline in the 4th century. Indeed, Pompeius Trogus, in the abbreviated work of Justin, puts a far more positive spin on the accession and career of Darius III. Before ascending the throne, he was known as Codomannus, and he gained fame for himself and his countrymen when he defeated, in single combat, a champion of the rebel Cadousians. The reputation for cowardice that has adhered to the man for more than 2 millennia was clearly unfounded and based on a willful misinterpretation of his later actions. Pompeius Trogus's source was far more generous, and indeed truthful, when he wrote that Darius fought a protracted war against Alexander the Great with varying success and great courage, but eventually he was defeated by Alexander and murdered by his own kinsmen. Justin's summary of regime change places Darius and Ochus in sharp contrast. There is no mention of Arses or the kingmaker Bagoas, and it is unclear whether this can be attributed to Justin's careless abbreviation or to the possibility that Pompeius Trogus used a different source for Book 10 from what he used for the following 2 books, which dealt with Alexander. Achaemenid court politics were, of course, far more complex than Greek historians were able to comprehend. Nevertheless, it is true that there was a destabilization that allowed the Macedonians, despite a succession crisis of their own, to initiate the campaign in the face of lesser opposition. That is not to say that the Persian satraps, or Darius himself, would have mounted a more serious challenge to the invader at this point, for it is highly likely that they regarded the forces at their disposal, that is, the satrapal armies supported by a large contingent of Greek mercenaries, as sufficient. The advance force, under Parmenion and his staff, had enjoyed only limited success in the years 336 and 335, proving scarcely more dangerous than the Spartan contingents who harassed northwestern Asia Minor in the 390s. Experience, it seems, had taught different lessons to the antagonists. Persia measured Greek invading armies by the ineffectual campaigns of Agesilaus and his predecessors. The notion that Agesilaus could have brought Persia to its knees is fantasy, and it is pure exaggeration to say he overran a large part of Asia, mastering the open country, and finally would probably have succeeded, had not the Spartans recalled him because of political affairs, in reducing the whole Persian Empire to the direst straits. Nevertheless, the Greco-Macedonians believed that the expedition of Cyrus the Younger had exposed the vulnerability of the Persian Empire. Xenophon himself remarks in his Anabasis, "It was clear to anyone who paid close attention to the size of the king's empire that it was strong in terms of lands and men, but weak on account of the great distances of road and the dispersal of its forces, if someone made a quick military strike against it." Indeed, the Athenian general Chabrias was said to have remarked that Pharnabazus was quick with words but slow in action, to which the satrap replied that his words were his own, but that the great king was master of his actions. The picture of inefficiency endured. Plutarch observed that the escape of the 10,000 from the heart of the empire made clear that the great king's empire, though rich in gold, luxury, and women, was nothing but smoke and mirrors, and thus encouraged the Greeks to despise the barbarians. 2. The arrival of the advance or expeditionary force in the spring of 336 gave hope to those in coastal Asia Minor who thought to use the power of Macedon to bring about revolution at home, with the concomitant independence from Persian control. It should be noted, however, that liberation and regime change went hand in hand. Freedom was little more than a political slogan. Local politics and factional strife dictated that since the ruling party was propped up by Persian power, its overthrow demanded a champion of equal or greater power. Whatever words were used to justify revolution, the truth remained that the Greeks of Asia Minor were on the verge of exchanging one overlord for another. In Ephesus, at the town of Eresus on Lesbos, however, the liberators anticipated the full-scale invasion, which at this time they expected Philip to lead, by erecting altars to Philip and instituting regime change. The Ephesians made their intentions clear. Democratic revolution, with the expulsion of the pro-Persian oligarchs, occurred very soon after the arrival in Asia of the expeditionary force under Parmenion and Attalus. The promise of Macedonian protection was surely what gave the Democrats the courage to act, and they sought the king's patronage by placing a statue of him in the Temple of Artemis. Whether this was in keeping with Philip's evolving view of his position, or the stimulus for further connections with the divine world, is unclear. Certainly, there was an earlier cult of Amyntas III in Pydna and one of Philip in Amphipolis. We are told that on the day of his daughter's wedding, he arranged a procession in the theatre in Ege, Vergina, in which the statues of the 12 enthroned Olympian gods were displayed, along with a 13th, Philip himself, seated among them. But this display was followed by the assassination of Philip in front of a crowd that included foreign dignitaries, an act that put the invasion of Asia on hold and left the Ephesian Democrats in a precarious state with regard to both their political enemies and their Persian overlords. How long they held on to power is unclear, but it is certain that by the time of Alexander's crossing in 334, the oligarchs had staged a successful counter-revolution under the leadership of Serfax and his family, and with military support from Memnon of Rhodes. The primary purpose, and thus the actual progress of the expeditionary force under Parmenion and Attalus is unclear, and we know only of the occupation of Magnesia.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?